This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, activists in New York held a tribunal on ethnic cleansing, another term for the gentrification that is destabilizing Black neighborhoods across the country. And the organization created by and for U.S. political prisoners gets ready to celebrate its 20th anniversary.
But first, Dr. Gerald Horn, the prolific professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, has another book out. It's titled The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean.
What's striking about today's United States, among other things, is that the term settler colonialism is not even part of the leftist vocabulary in this country, which is quite shocking, not even in terms of their examination of history, but even more than that, in terms of trying to comprehend the fiasco that we are facing with the November 2016 presidential election, there was rarely an attempt to look at the origins of settler colonialism in North America as a direct product of class collaboration between and amongst poor and richer Europeans, which obviously it was. And with this vaunted bourgeois democracy and then vaunted enlightenment, basically not necessarily coming full-blown from the rich imaginations of hiding the potted wigs, hiding the brains of these European men, but actually a direct response to material conditions on the ground. The fact the folks from Europe found themselves in a war zone that they were trying to defeat rambunctious indigenous populations, trying to enslave rebellious Africans, and in order to do so, concessions had to be made across class lines to poor Europeans in particular. And like Colin Kaepernick, the now famed, defrocked San Francisco 49ers quarterback, my attention has been drawn to Bacon's Rebellion in 1676 in colonial Virginia, which not only was a turning point in terms of settler colonialism, but in some ways fixed the paradigm for what was to follow for the next 340 plus years. And certainly fixed the paradigm for what was to ensue 100 years later in 1776, that Nathaniel Bacon, a man of means, led a revolt of poor Europeans, and I'm afraid to say some terribly misguided Africans too, against the colonial regime because they thought that the regime was not moving rapidly enough to take the land away from the Native Americans and disperse it to them. And if you understand Bacon's Rebellion, as it has been called, and likewise, if you understand how that rebellion has been misinterpreted by generations of so-called left-wing historians who are always quick to salute these kinds of rebellions without looking at what the ultimate aim is, which is like saluting the rebellion that supposedly took place at the ballot box in November 2016 without looking at what the ultimate result was. If you understand that kind of phenomenon, you'll be able to understand better what's going on in the contemporary United States of America. And once you come to that realization, I'm afraid that you'll come to the similar realization that it's actually worse than it looks.
Yes, leftists herald or hail Bacon's Rebellion as a glimpse of the potential for black-white worker unity. But you see it as a missed opportunity for solidarity between blacks and Native Americans, the two groups that were being crushed by the settlers.
Well, absolutely. And the crushing of black Native American resistance has been a central theme of settler colonialism. That is to say that another episode that sheds light on contemporary events in the United States of America is the offer by the U.S. government of what had been Spanish Florida circa 1820, and how that led to some of the most serious wars that the United States government was involved in. I'm speaking of the wars of the people we refer to as the Seminoles, who fundamentally had merged with the African population, an African population that was largely Angolan, by the way, and how they fought in 1819, just prior to the U.S. takeover. They fought again in the 1830s, and they fought again in the 1850s. And so there was decades of conflict between Native Americans and Africans on the one side and the U.S. government on the other before the former was defeated, and then, as so often happened, were deported en masse. Northern Mexico, where their descendants continued to reside. One of the points I make in this book, Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, is the nature of ethnic cleansing in North America, which not only involved mass murder, it also involved mass enslavement of the indigenous population who in some ways were deported en masse. You can find today Native American DNA all over the world because they were sent to the slave markets of Turkey. They were sent to Madagascar. They were sent all over the world. And this was not only a way to make money, it was a way to cleanse the land of their presence and thereby replace them with European settlers. And somehow this obscene and horrid process has been characterized even by some who consider themselves to be radical, believe it or not, as a step forward for humanity. I'm laughing, but it's bitter, sardonic laughter, because if you can take that position, if you can rationalize ethnic cleansing, genocide, mass enslavement, you can rationalize anything. You can rationalize the election of Donald J. Trump.
Yes, it's been estimated that with the European assault and conquest of the New World, 1/5 of the world's population, the Native Americans, were wiped out.
And that may be a conservative estimate if you look at the precipitous drop in their numbers. And once again, 1676 was a turning point in terms of settler colonialism, because not only did you have Bacon's Rebellion in what is now Virginia, which led to the acceleration of the construction of the identity politics of whiteness. And by the way, once again, it's so curious that this dismissive term, identity politics, is rarely, if ever, applied by those on the left to the construction of whiteness, which, of course, was the original toxic version of identity politics. But in 1676, you also had King Philip's War in New England, which was part of this ongoing effort to wipe out the Native American population, cleanse them from that territory, and then sell them into slavery in the Caribbean, into the slave markets of Ottoman Turkey, etc. But then in Barbados, you had a major uprising of Africans as well. And so looking from London in 1676, they saw these three major rebellions. And it was very difficult from their point of view to conciliate or somehow compromise with the Africans in Barbados or the indigenous population in New England. And so the least bad option was compromising with the settlers in Virginia accelerating the process of cleansing the indigenous population from the land of Virginia, dispersing that land to poor European settlers, heightening the construction of whiteness, thereby lessening the contradiction between and amongst not only Protestants and Catholics, which had been the animating factor of settler colonialism for most of the 17th century, but also seeking conciliation with a Jewish settler community as well. And that became the theme that led to 1776 and the creation of the first apartheid state, the United States of America, which, despite denials to the contrary, even by some of our friends on the left, was doling out rights and privileges on the basis of melanin deficiency, not least in the first immigration law of 1790, and is also reflected in the continuing movement west to take the land of the Native Americans, cleanse them from that land, and then stock that land with enslaved Africans, because, as we know, after 1776, the new nation, the apartheid state, the United States of America, replaced London as the captain of the international slave trade, and then leveraged that position in North America to take over control of the international slave trade to Cuba by the 1790s, and to Brazil, the biggest market of all, by the 1840s. Not only that, they were then assisted by their comrades in the so-called Lone Star Republic, speaking of Texas, which seceded from Mexico in 1836, since Mexico in the 1820s, under leadership of a president of African descent, Vicente Guerrero, had moved to abolish slavery. And just like the United States of America was formed in rebellion against growing abolitionism in London, as reflected in 1772 in Somerset's case, by the way, also reflected in the film Belle, starring Gugu Mbatha Roy. But likewise, the Texians, as they were called, led by Stephen F. Austin and Sam Houston, who have now bequeathed their names to two of the major metropolises in what is now Texas, revolted and seceded from Mexico because of abolitionism. And then after 1836, you had these Texians who were trying to elbow the United States out of the lush slave markets of Cuba and Brazil, but were not able to withstand the pressure exerted upon them by heroic abolitionist Haiti, which was able to win over abolitionist London, and Texas felt that they were about to be overrun as an independent state, so therefore they joined the Union in 1845, becoming, until the ascension of Alaska in 1959, the biggest state territorially within the Union. So this is part of a larger project to rewrite a more accurate and to produce a more accurate history of the United States of America, because I dare say we'll find it difficult to dig ourselves out of the hole in which we find ourselves until we have an accurate estimation of how we got here.
And you explore in this book how the invention of whiteness has its roots not just as a New World phenomenon, but in Europe and in the slave trade.
Well, the slave trade is very interesting. One of the points I make in this book is that one of the problems that the Western Europeans had as they were sailing southward from Bristol and Liverpool and the French port to West Africa to enslave Africans is that they could find themselves enslaved by the Turks, who were then ruling a good deal of North Africa and then sold into slavery in the Ottoman Turkish slave markets. Therefore, another turning point in terms of explaining why you have so many people of African descent in North America speaking a language developed in Northwest Europe comes in 1683, when the Ottoman Turks or turned back at the gates of Vienna on their westward march, which in some ways is greeted with delirious ecstasy in Western Europe, because with the setback to the Ottoman Turks, they recognized they could more easily sell southward to enslave Africans. I should also say that the enslavement of Europeans, including Euro-Americans, continues, but not to the same degree. I mean, for example, I'm sure you're familiar with the Marine hymn from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, and the story in the early 19th century about President Thomas Jefferson seeking to avoid paying ransom to rescue Euro-Americans who had been captured and enslaved in North Africa. But that particular vignette should also lead to a larger truth that I would like to impart, particularly to strugglers in Native America and Black America, which is that in terms of trying to dig ourselves out of the hole in which we find ourselves, we would serve our cause greatly by paying attention to the larger, wider global context. Because if you don't understand the larger, wider global context, you can't understand how we got into this hole in the first place. And so just focusing in a micro sense on what's happening on the block or what's happening in Washington really is not going to do the job. You really have to take a macro point of view. You really have to look with a wide lens at what's happening globally.
You position the Haitian and the Russian revolutions as two of the most important social upheavals of the last couple of centuries. Most of Western scholars, of course, would not agree with that and would be insulted if you did not include the events of 1776.
Well, I understand these, quote, Western, unquote, scholars, because, as noted, 1776 did lead to the liberation and liberty of countless numbers of Europeans. And the fact that they're unable to understand the profundity of the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, the Russian Revolution, 1917, really only exposes the naked white supremacy and racism that even has a left-wing form, I'm afraid, as suggested by the maunderings of some of these writers who rather inaccurately and awkwardly consider themselves to be radical. What I mean is that the Haitian Revolution led to a general crisis of the entire system, including in North America, that could only be resolved with its collapse. That is to say, with the Haitian Revolution, London realized the jig was up, knowing that the Haitian Revolution in the first place, as you know, had Jamaican participation. Jamaica was the cash cow for London. And rather than run the risk of losing that investment, not to mention their lives, London moved to abolish the slave trade in 1807 and slavery itself in 1833. The Yankees, who, of course, had a project that was premised and based upon the slave trade and slavery, dug in their heels, which forced a mighty civil war, leading to the slaughter of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. And then, of course, a war that could not have been won without the participation of tens of thousands of black soldiers. And then, of course, we were to be repaid afterwards by being deported en masse, which we were able to thwart and foil. The Russian Revolution, 1917, not only helped to shift the discourse away from race to class, but for reasons that include destabilizing its antagonists, the colonial powers of Western Europe, not to mention solidarity with the oppressed, not least in Africa and the Caribbean, you can't begin to understand liberation and the decolonization of Africa without understanding aid from Moscow. I'm writing a big book now that will probably be published in Zimbabwe next year on U.S. imperialism and anti-communism and the liberation of Southern Africa. And there's no doubt that the liberation forces in Southern Africa would not have been as successful if they had not been armed by Moscow, just like the Cuban troops who did the heavy lifting in terms of the defeat of the apartheid military on the battlefields of Southern Angola and Northern Namibia were armed by Moscow. And just like what helped to convince the apartheid authorities in Pretoria to negotiate with sweet reason was the Damocletian sword hanging over their head in the form of a threatened Cuban invasion, not only of Namibia, but also of what was then Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, but also marching to Pretoria itself and forcibly ejecting these racists from office. That's what helped to induce sweet reason and compromise on their part. And likewise, it's no accident, as F.W. de Klerk, the last apartheid ruler of South Africa, says in his speech before Parliament on February 2nd, 1990, the reason he had decided to free Nelson Mandela and unban the ANC, the African National Congress, was precisely because weeks earlier the Berlin Wall had collapsed, and he sensed that the major bulwark of support for the liberation forces had just been weakened mightily, and that it's best to negotiate with a weakened opponent rather than a strengthened opponent. So once again, in trying to understand the black condition, not understanding the macro context and looking at it through a wide lens, obviously is going to lead you into a dead end and a blind alley. But I understand why people don't do it, because they recognize that if they do go down that road, they may get a beat down from these white supremacists, which I'm afraid to say is probably the case.
That was scholar and author Gerald Horn speaking from Houston.
In New York, the December 12th movement organized a citywide tribunal on ethnic cleansing to identify and denounce the forces behind gentrification of black neighborhoods. Black Agenda Radio's Nellie Bailey is a veteran tenants organizer. She was among those that testified before the tribunal.
Distinguished jurists and the audience, I'm very happy to be here because ethnic cleansing is clearly decimating black lives, black communities, and it is done and sanctioned by the U.S. government, as has always been the case. First, I would like to say it's impossible to frame this discussion outside the context of capitalism, which is racism, because capitalism cannot exist without racism. Now, Roger has talked about a United Nations Commission of 1939 that codified ethnic cleansing as the planned deliberate removal from a specific territory, persons of a particular ethnic group by force or intimidation in order to render that area ethnically homogeneous, end of quote. Ethnic cleansing specifically addresses race as a motivating factor, whereas gentrification, coined by British sociologist Ruth Glass in 1964, was based on her study of white working class displacement in inner city London. However, over half a century later, gentrification has steadily morphed into a global displacement strategy advanced by finance capital and an ethnic cleansing process that negates social reproduction to the hegemony of investment capital. The intersection of neoliberal urban planning, such as what we see today with our current mayor, Bill de Blasio, patterns of investments, evictions, and homelessness can only produce uneven development, a natural outcome of capitalism. Dr. Mindy Fullilove documents in her 2004 publication, Roots Shock, Demolition of Americans' Urban Neighborhoods, and she's talking about black neighborhoods. Decades of so-called urban renewal policies that destroyed an estimated 1,600 black communities across the country between 1949 and 1973. In 1963, sociologist Kenneth Clark interviewed James Baldwin about urban renewal. It was shortly after Baldwin met with then U.S. Attorney General Robert Kennedy, and it was to discuss the destruction of these black communities. Well, during that interview with Clark, Baldwin indicted the U.S. government as an accomplice in the destruction of black communities under the pretense of urban renewal that Baldwin dubbed as Negro removal. In 1979, housing activist Yolanda Ward presented her, I believe, seminal work titled Spatial Deconcentration to a national housing conference in Washington, D.C. The heavily researched study exposed the federal government's plan to disperse blacks from major inner cities after these centers exploded with urban rebellions during the 1960s. The frequency and scope of the uprisings sent shockwaves throughout the U.S. ruling class. In July of 1967, the Detroit riots, just let me back up a little bit, it sent shockwaves that so alarmed the U.S. ruling class that they asked or tried to pressure President Johnson to suspend the Constitution because they wanted to classify, and later on did classify, these urban rebellions as a threat to national security. Now let's talk about these riots and what it meant. In July of 1967, the Detroit riots. In the end, 33 blacks and 10 whites were killed, 1,189 injured, and over 7,200 arrested. Property damage was estimated at $32 million. Now, in today's finance market, the $32 million would be almost $1 trillion. So we're talking about different equations here. Detroit was the largest urban rebellion in the 1960s. Before Detroit, the Harlem Rebellion exploded in 1964, that spread it to Bed-Stuy and up to Rochester, New York, Watts in 1965, Newark, New Jersey in 1967. And this is when the House Un-American Affairs Committee tried to pressure Johnson into suspending the Constitution and to declare martial law in the cities, but Johnson refused. Within the ruling class, the shockwaves and distress were so monumentous that they wanted LBJ, as I said before, to declare martial law. And so Johnson came up with the Kerner Report, an 11-member commission to look at what was happening. And we all remember that famous saying in the Kerner's Report, the U.S. is moving toward two separate societies, one black and one white. Now we have to remember that was nearly half a century ago. So in this commission, you will read about the commission members, but what you don't read so readily are the consultant and contractors hired by the commission. They were army generals, chiefs of police, I think 32 of them in all. It was a military tribunal because the outcome was that of social control. Hence, spatial deconcentration, because how and where can we disperse this unruly population that is isolated from major cities? And we can talk about this later on. Hopefully some of you will have some questions about how they did it, because I want to talk about planned shrinkage here in New York City. In 1973, Abe Beame was elected mayor of New York City, and it was at the time of the economic crisis of the city that they conveniently blamed on poor people, as they usually do, poor blacks and Latinos. But what it was really about, planned shrinkage, was to reduce essential and vital services, and they targeted two communities, Harlem and the Bronx. And we all remember how the Bronx was burning. And so the plan was, you just suspend the services, no sanitation, no garbage pickup, just all of the vital services, because the strategy was to drive out the population, which in part they succeeded. And then later on to return with an investment strategy that will bring in whites. Now I just want to talk about some of the tools of gentrification that facilitates ethnic cleansing. We have, first of all, we have to talk about this, the Black Misleadership class. The collaborators. And hopefully the next conference we have will be about agents and collaborators in the age of Black ethnic cleansing. That's what we need. So we also have zoning and rezoning, which Bill de Blasio is pushing, which every major non-for-profit, if they had any guts or neighborhood groups, are opposed, because they know what it means. It means you gotta go. Your Black businesses, you gotta go. And this neoliberal fraud perpetuates this lie and this strategy as a program to help Blacks and Latinos, when in fact it is to destroy Blacks and Latinos in this city, to eradicate their presence in this city. And he thinks because he can point to his family, everything is fine, because they know that we as Black people love symbolism. We love it. Obama went after public housing, the private-public partnership. He wasn't our friend. All right, that's it for me.
Nellie Bailey at the Tribunal on Ethnic Cleansing. Activist and Episcopal priest Frank Morales told the tribunal that gentrifiers need to be confronted on the streets of the targeted cities.
What I'm talking about is the symbiosis between the capitalist, the greed of capitalism, it's built into the system, right? Mm-hmm. To continually extract profits from the land.
That's correct.
You push those out who can't afford anymore, and you bring in people who can pay the bills. But the symbiosis that I'm talking about is between the economic motives of ethnic cleansing alongside the motives of social control.
Right.
Because what we saw in the late 60s, particularly with the Kerner Commission and other aspects, is that the primary motive seen there was to push folks out of the cities because they were the fear of the insurrectionist tendencies that were happening in the urban centers.
Okay.
And to create the shelter system. It would be a lot cheaper, for instance, in New York City, right? To take the $1 billion a year that's being put forward for the so-called shelter industry, right? To shelter so-called homeless people, which are none other than former tenants, right? It would be a lot cheaper to renovate all the vacant houses. I had three times more vacant spaces in New York City than there are homeless people. It would be a lot cheaper to renovate those houses through urban homesteading programs and others, which were legal in New York City. You didn't have to break the locks. There were programs that guys and families could go in and work those houses, and after 2 or 3 years, assume title to those. It's called urban homesteading. This was legal. It would be a lot cheaper to take homeless people in New York City, allow them the opportunity to renovate these houses. So why isn't that done? From a hard-headed business sense, that makes sense. No, there's no intent to house people to create the kind of stability that a home brings, because then people make further demands. They want better schools, they want better health care, and so on. The housing is the base. Once you're disempowered and disorganized and so on through the loss of your home or the threat of the loss of your home, you can't organize around anything else. You see, so that's the point. There's no intent. The whole foreclosure crisis, the whole is rocking the working class now. They want to keep everybody so they can, the Pentagon can continue with its global domination project. The people are suffering in the obscenity of the so-called prison system and all of that. People can't organize if their homes are continually under threat. That's the attack of the base. We have to attack that at the base. Going to the top of the pyramid and pleading for homes and housing and so forth is not going to happen. At the base, we can secure through direct action and self-defense and bring masses of people into the street. Defend those folks who are facing evictions. Right? Utilize all the means that you can legally to maintain. But clearly, the brother was talking about, he can only do so much. He's one guy. We have to create a heat on the street through masses of people. Then the policy doors will be open. They'll want to meet with the leaders right away, you see, and start to make some change. But until we make a move like that at the base, seizing the vacant housing on the offense, defense, defending those folks who are facing eviction to these predatory, all that bullshit, right? Then you're going to see some changes. Then you're going to see some changes.
That was Father Frank Morales at a tribunal against ethnic cleansing in New York City.
The National Jericho Movement was founded by and in support of political prisoners in the United States. The movement is now 20 years old. Black Agenda Radio producer Kyle Frazier spoke with Jericho co-chair Jihad Abdul Mumit.
Jericho Amnesty Movement is having its 20th anniversary on Saturday, March the 24th, this year, 2018. It's going to be at the Holy Rood Episcopal Church, which is 715 West 179th Street in New York City. The dinner will be from 5 to 6, and the program itself will be from 6:30 to 9. And we're expecting to be blessed with the presence of our dear beloved comrade brother who was pardoned by Barack Obama's last days of presidentship here in the United States, freedom fighter Oscar Lopez Rivera. And I also will be one of the keynote speakers there. And we have a whole host of other activities that will be going on. But really, any organization doing this type of revolutionary political work, namely campaigning to get freedom for the freedom fighters or political prisoners that's in the United States, particularly those that's been involved in the movement stemming from the Civil Rights Movement and the National Liberation Movements of the 60s and the 70s, and then actions related to that beyond that. To be in existence for 20 years is something to be celebrated and applauded. Many of the prisons that we represent in Jericho are from the Black Panther Party. They've been incarcerated for 40 plus, going on 50 years now. And the Black Panther Party itself, the lifespan of this dynamic organization starting from October 1966, and I guess according to the government, written off and put in the casket in 1973, as far as they're concerned, and the movement, that's seven years. And a lifespan of any organization that's in the field actively doing this type of work that existed for 20 years is something to be commended. So we will be celebrating that in the sense of acknowledging our accomplishments, but at the same time, coming around to a sobering reminder of all the work that still has to be done, particularly with respect to all those that are still incarcerated with no legal light at the end of the tunnel, legal meaning legal in terms of release from state government or the federal government. In order for that to happen, we have to really march further and harder than ever before. So this will be like a galvanizing event, celebrating our accomplishments, because a lot of times in the movement, we don't do that. We're so revolutionary, we think that it's like not the proper thing to do. But you know, psychologically, we need that. We need that joy and energy that we can muster from ourselves, and that's what we're going to do. And at the same time, we're not going to lose sight of what we have to do moving forward. So this 20th anniversary celebration will embrace all of those aspects of it and acknowledging the accomplishments and the efforts of many people and other organizations that have been in the field doing similar type of work or work in the community. That's what we're looking for from the 20th anniversary. And everybody listening is invited to attend.
No doubt. And as you stated, 20 years is a minute to sustain the kind of revolutionary work and efforts that the Jericho movement has been sustaining. 98, this is before 9/11. This is a distinctly different period in this kind of struggle and questions of political prisoners. Could you just give your assessment of the difference between the political prisoner struggle then in the late 90s to today?
Okay, very good question, brother. Well, definitely things have changed. I mean, I guess the nodal point was the 9/11 September 11th incident there. That makes it all the more stellar, the fact that an organization such as Jericho and any other similar organization saluting everyone, you know, because there's no real sense of movement like it used to be, you know, where there's a certain level of pervasive consciousness amongst the people on the street and in the community, you know, of struggle, revolutionary struggle as such. So really, we're really struggling and campaigning in a vacuum, so to speak. A lot of times when we go to present to the community in different seminars and conferences and programs and demonstrations and marches, we really have to start at zero in explaining the fact that, number one, there are political prisoners in the United States. Number two, what in fact is a political prisoner? And really trying to counter all the pushback from the media and the status quo and the power to be that say there are no political prisoners in the United States, let alone those that you're talking about. Those type, they are criminals. So we have to do this whole explanation piece to educate people. So that's what I mean, that we're really like in a vacuum in presenting this issue. And then moving further, additional challenge of those present-day activists that are in the streets and dealing with real-life serious issues today, making sure that they are being able to draw a connection with their historical roots. And the best way to draw a connection with those historical roots of struggle, to acknowledge, recognize, and support those freedom fighters. Because if you don't do that, it's almost like you're planting yourself without any root. You're setting yourself up not to be able to learn some lessons in history and to draw strength from our ancestors and all the work that has been done. So this is a major challenge. So that's what happens today, post 9/11. We have to always confront this as if it's a novel issue, a new issue, get people to understand it and see it. Before that, that didn't necessarily have to go down like that because people was really on that page. Now the apathy is set in, the buying in, that the fact that there's no political prisoners has set in, and fear has set in. The government's position itself that the retaliation and the retribution, you know, is that people may not want to reckon with the fact of being in prison or being ostracized or being investigated by the FBI or state police or whatever government structure there is. And that's hard to reckon with an everyday person without any revolutionary consciousness. And that revolutionary consciousness is not as pervasive as it used to be. That's the major difference to me. So our struggle is even harder today than it was back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and 90s.
And for those of us unfamiliar with the roots of Jericho back in the late 90s, could you just briefly discuss for us how Jericho got started?
Okay, well, Jericho was started basically in 1998. And its founders were Jalil Abdul-Muttaqin, who is still a political prisoner in the state of New York, and he's been there for well over 40 years, over 45 years. The other co-founders were Herman Ferguson, who passed away several years ago, and assisted by the name of Safia Bukhari, who also passed away. So these individuals coming to the call of having an organized body, organized effort, corralling the forces needed to be able to acknowledge, recognize, and support those that have made that type of sacrifice and were captured by the state in their efforts to gain independence, to gain freedom, to challenge racism, to fight against police brutality in our communities, to struggle to feed, clothe, and shelter and organize our communities. So Jericho was started by these beloved individuals, and it carries on by freedom fighters who have been released from prison and those other revolutionary comrades, sisters, and brothers who have come to the call, many of whom have not even been incarcerated, and this is a very wonderful thing. Isn't it interesting that we always said that Jericho would be in the organizational leadership, there would be freedom fighters that were incarcerated, former political prisoners. And so the day, because time does pass and we're all getting older, so we do recognize the fact that there will always be political prisoners. There will always be prisoners of war in any country, in any land where we're fighting for our freedom and fighting against oppression. But those of us that's been around from these movements of the 60s and 70s, we're dying. We're getting older and we're dying. So we look at the evolution of Jericho that's going to have the mantle has to be passed for those sisters and brothers that perhaps oftentimes may not have been incarcerated themselves and did not necessarily come from those movements themselves. So our roots are there to grow some new flowers. That yellow flower that they talk about, it's an old story that in the Jewish concentration camps, you know, where people had to walk across, and I know we don't like to talk about the Jewish struggle, but I do. I talk about all struggle, people under some type of oppression, but this is a particular story where people were forced to walk across a mountain, snow-capped mountains, just like Africans were forced to walk across hot, burning fields. And in the middle of it all, there's one story that says there's a flower growing, a yellow flower. So we have to seek out and nurture those yellow flowers that are growing through the concretes of our city jungles and our folks' snow-capped mountains and be able to keep the organization of Jericho alive. So there's enough roots and there's enough nourishment there to be able to foster and continue the struggle of Jericho to free our freedom fighters then and now.
Yes, and you mentioned that the sole remaining living co-founder of Jericho, Brother Jaleel Muntakim, is still to this day a political prisoner, a prisoner of war. Brother Muntakim has developed a new campaign. Could you let us know a bit about this campaign and its aims?
Yes, indeed. This is a powerful thing here. So now you have a freedom fighter that's been in prison for 4 decades or more, and he, along with others also, but just speaking about Brother Jaleel, he's sent out this proposal and call for an international initiative to gain recognition and support for political prisoners in the United States. Now, this international initiative is not necessarily something new. You know, Al-Haj Miguel Shabazz, also known as Malcolm X, had said in the 60s that we have to take our struggle to the United Nations and make our struggle not just a civil rights struggle, but a human rights struggle, which this indeed is. And so what is happening here is we repackaged it. And now, because of Brother Jaleel, with his energy and motivation from behind the prison wall, have galvanized us in such a way that, well, not that we couldn't do it ourselves, but in a way that we haven't done it yet in a long time. And this is such a wonderful thing. So we high salute for Jaleel. So this initiative is called In the Spirit of Nelson Mandela. I'm using Nelson Mandela's name onto it, because he also was a political prisoner for 26 and a half years on Robben Island in South Africa. And his name itself may attract the attention of many people, more so than anybody else. And also there's some Mandela rules off of the Nelson Mandela experience that kind of outlines what the conditions of incarceration should and should not be, most of which are being violated by the United States of America. So here we are in the spirit of Nelson Mandela, and what we are doing is we have several lines of communication being developed and established with international organizations one being the International Commission of Jurists, to try to get the United Nations Human Rights Council to call for a special hearing and bring attention to our political prisons. Also, the International Commission of Jurists, back in 1979, had come over to the United States and visited Ed Poindexter, who was one of our freedom fighters in prison in Nebraska State Penitentiary, and Sundiata Kohli, who was Sister Sada Shakur and Malik Shakur's co-defendant, well, rap partner, comrade. Now, Malik Shakur was assassinated on the turnpike, and Sada Shakur has international legal amnesty granted to her by the nation of Cuba. But Sundiata is still in prison. So they went to see both these brothers back in 1979, and now we're asking them to revisit them 40 years later. 39 years later, and we're looking for a favorable response, and hopefully this entity will be able to bring this issue before the United Nations Human Rights Council, and hopefully from there we'll be able to have hearings and bring broader international attention to our freedom fighters. That's not the only coal in the fire that we have, because we also have other connections with different organizations throughout the world, actually, and we're trying the same thing, to get them to join on and endorse and support our campaign to free our freedom fighters. You know, a lot of times, you know, we are quick to champion the cause of those that's going through oppression around the world, which is always a good thing, but getting those to reciprocate is another type of struggle. So that's what this initiative is calling for. We're trying to organize our struggle on an international level and bring that attention back to the United States so that the world can see what's going on with our freedom fighters, with these individuals. And in turn, we're hoping to leverage through the state and federal government to bring condemnation, and hopefully that will lead to political sway to get them out of prison. People have been pardoned by state and federal governments, but not black people, not black freedom fighters. So we're trying to make that point also. And with a salute to all of our other freedom fighters of different nationalities, but that hasn't happened with our black New African freedom fighters. You know, we're always at the bottom, man. Our struggle is always the hardest. And even when it comes to international attention and efforts and what goes on, so we're trying to change that dynamic and through this initiative. And we're calling on everybody that's hearing this message to tune in with us at Jericho Movement to be able to support that whole thing. We're in the day and age now where sometimes, as I said in the beginning, we almost feel like we have to twist the arm of our community to do these type of things. And one of the distinct difference between the 60s and the 70s, young brothers and sisters who at that time I was 16 years old joining the Black Panther Party, young brothers and sisters, you couldn't stop us from reading a book. You couldn't stop us on anything. Nobody had to twist our arm for us to find out the essential things we need to know about our history. What happened in slavery? Where did we go? What were the organizations and movements before our time? So we would have the strength and the ammunition to really move forward and fight hard. Today, with all the technology around us, internet, cell phones, you just ask Siri anything, we find ourselves so many times in the weird, awkward position, the frustrating position of begging and pleading our black community to look up and recognize those who fought before them. This is a big turnaround, brother. It's not to slight any of the wonderful sisters and brothers, and there are quite a few. They're out there, you know, putting in their work, organizing and addressing the issue. But the masses of us that are not, it's shame on you. Shame on you to have to have somebody debate you to support somebody that's fought for our freedom. Shame on you to have to beg you to go get a book and read about so-and-so. I mean, you get what you deserve. But unfortunately, you know, there's so many people that are, and I say you get what you deserve, it's affecting everybody, even those that are trying to struggle. You know, there's an old Islamic tradition that says that there's two levels of a boat, and the people on the bottom of the level of the boat were drilling holes in the boat, letting water in. So the responsibility of those on the top is to stop those from drilling holes in the bottom of the boat so that everybody won't sink. Well, those drilling holes in the bottom of the boat are reflective of ignorance and apathy and complacency. If we don't do something to revitalize ourselves, everybody's going to suffer. Everybody's going to suffer. And one of the best ways, as I said in the beginning of this interview, of being connected with your roots, to understand your roots, is to support those living freedom fighters that are alive today, incarcerated in these prisons, and to make your effort along with whatever else you're doing in the community, whatever beautiful work you're doing in the community, to get them out. That's our responsibility, to seek out the knowledge and find it and act upon it. That's our calling today.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.